Hello, everybody. This is Rob Fredette with the podcast HodgePod, and welcome. I have another special guest. Doug Carey is joining me, and he is the author, and he's also a true crime investigator, and he's joining me on my podcast episode. The book is called The Berman Murders, Unraveling the Mojave Desert's Most Mysterious Unsolved Crime. When we connected, I'm really looking forward to talking to you, Doug. And first of all, welcome to my podcast.
Oh, thank you, Rob. I appreciate it. Great to be here.
So this case here is really, you've written a book on it, and I've listened to a couple of podcast episodes, and I'm going to get the book as well, but this is an unsolved murder of a couple from the mid-1980s. Is that correct?
Right. Barry and Louise Berman disappeared from a campsite in a remote area of the Mojave Desert on January 6, 1986, and it wasn't for almost 3 years that their bodies were discovered miles away in a cut bank grave.
Wow. That is that's quite an unbelievable turn of events to find the bodies 3 years later. Is that almost unheard of when you think about it, looking back when you wrote the book and researched and actually did a lot of investigating?
Well, it was an unprecedented type of event for this particular area. Now, look, people, Rob, in the desert do disappear sometimes, and I've worked on several of those cases, and it happens. One of the deputies who worked doggedly on this case told me at one point, it's not that uncommon for people to walk off into the desert and never come back. And we hear those kinds of stories and tales. But in this particular locale, this particular couple who had experience in the backcountry and were in an area that is kind of a counterculture mecca, miles from the nearest paved road, very peaceful, mellow kind of spot where people take off their clothes and bathe naked in these beautiful stone and cement hot tubs where natural hot springs water is piped. For them to just go on a morning walk and not come back and then end up murdered. Yeah, I mean, it was totally unheard of. And for those of us who liked the area, it just cast a pall over that spot.
So if we could, how long have you been a true crime investigator? And how long did it take you to write and research this book, which I find fascinating? So if you could talk about that, if you will.
Well, Rob, I've always been interested in writing. When I was young, I read a lot, you know, Hemingway, Steinbeck. Mm-hmm. I loved reading and fancied that I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't yet have a voice or really know what I wanted to write about. Did a little bit of journalism in college, and then later took a shot at writing a couple of novels, but they didn't go anywhere because I didn't yet really know what I wanted. But starting about 15 years ago, I began writing about law, and that brought me into the true crime arena. And I found that I really liked working on these cases. They're fascinating, and they involve elemental human drama. The other thing about it is that there's an audience for it. There are people who really like to read it, and it's nice to write something and have people respond to it and be interested in it. So part of it is that I found myself drawn towards these kinds of stories, and part of it is that there are folks who like to read it. This story started off as a piece for LA Weekly, a cover story, and then I kept following the case, writing more articles about it. And I had in mind maybe I would write a book, but Rob, I worked off and on for 9 years on this project before it finally came into fruition as the book, The Berman Murders.
I've had authors on my podcast. Some take a year. I've had an author that takes 12 years to write a book, so 9 years. That's a lot of time invested, is it not?
It's a lot of time invested, and it was off and on again. I mean, I work as a chief legal officer at a technology company. Don't hold it against me, but I'm a lawyer by background. And in fact, a lot of my background was in legal research and writing and fact finding. I was a trial lawyer. And because of that, I learned a lot of the skills that I apply to the work that I do. But yeah, it was a tremendous amount of work. And you know, all of those emotional ups and downs that you go through when you're working on a project like this. My gosh, will I ever get it done? It was a tough project. It's hard to go back so many years and try to plumb the depths of a very mysterious case and take a shot at figuring out what happened.
So you have to talk to folks who probably knew the Burmans. I know, understand that. And I've had also authors who've had to gain the trust of people that they're talking to. So how was that as you were trying to get information or writing this book and then coming to conclusion they were murdered? So what was that like talking to people? Did you have to gain trust for folks as you got to talk to them?
Of course, you're absolutely right, Rob. That's a big part of the process. And it's also part of the process of being a lawyer. If you're involved in a case and you're trying to unearth what happened, you have to be able to engage with people and ask questions and get them to share information. There were times when it was difficult. Some people were very cooperative. Leon Boyer, the deputy I mentioned, who had pursued this case for decades, just never let it go. He was wonderful, shared a lot of information and materials with me. Likewise, the Inyo County, California Sheriff's Office, this rural county where the murders occurred. So much time had passed, he felt that, well, what the heck? Might as well share the files, see if we can uncover anything. A lot of friends of the Burmans were cooperative. Some took a little more trust gaining than others. I was persistent. I kept coming back. The family members of the person I identify as the chief suspect and possible perpetrator, it took them a while to talk with me. But I think over time, people saw I was serious, that I was approaching the process without a preconceived notion or without wanting to just dwell on salacious facts. And really, I wanted to understand what happened and present an unbiased and authoritative account of these unsolved murders. And people began to warm to it. So in the end, I got a lot of cooperation from a whole diverse set of folks.
Yeah, I always like to say you were an investigator, you were doing research, and I also like, you're not like a flamethrower, which I like to say, you know, just to try to get sensational. You were actually doing the actual research, which I think you gained their trust. I think that's great. So explain where the Mojave Desert is, because is it the weather gets really extreme at the Mojave Desert? Does it get really hot and really cold? So can you explain that, where the Burmans were, and how does that play into this?
The place where the Burmans disappeared is one of the most beautiful and isolated locales in the western United States. It's a place called Saline Valley. It's only about 200 air miles north from Los Angeles, but it's a world apart. It's ringed by tall mountains. It's west of Death Valley and east of the Owens Valley, in a part of California that sort of butts up against the Nevada border and is just hard to get to. It's almost like it's been preserved in time, and it's just a remarkable location. It's beautiful, stunningly beautiful. It's tough, Rob, to get into this valley to begin with. I mean, you take a paved road that itself seems like you're in the middle of nowhere. You're still an hour or two from Death Valley, just out in the middle of nowhere. And from there, you take a turn onto a rough dirt road that you have to follow for 50 miles, if it's even passable, to get over the mountains into Saline Valley. Now, once you're down in the valley, it's absolutely stunning. There's sand dunes, and there's a salt lake that kind of shimmers like dull silver. It's beautiful, completely silent, unless the wind is howling. And it's not a particularly windy spot, but when the wind's not howling, it's just dead silent. And it's like being on another planet. So it is a land of extremes. In the summer, it can easily get 120 degrees or more, and there's very little natural shade. In the winter in Saline Valley, it'll get down below freezing, but it's not so bad. However, the surrounding mountains yeah. often get so much snow that it's difficult to get in there anyway. But it's hard to describe. I do my best in the book, but if you haven't been out to the desert, just picture a spot that's almost unearthly, like being on the surface of Mars, only mm-hmm. there's air to breathe.
A few years ago, I drove my wife and I. We went out to LA and Las Vegas. We landed in LA and we drove to Las Vegas. Even though that was civilization, the AC did not work in the car. It was so hot, and we just wanted to get from point A to point B. And I can see where you said it was extreme, but even driving in that 2-hour, 3-hour stretch from LA to Las Vegas, it was steaming hot in the car, even with the AC.
That's some beautiful desert. I know a lot of people feel when they do that drive, and I do that drive a lot. I'm in Las Vegas right now. I work out of here most of the time, so this is where I'm based. I do a lot of writing for the Las Vegas Review Journal, and I mine the deserts of Nevada and California for these true crime stories. But yeah, it does feel like the middle of nowhere, and it is very extreme. As you get to know it, though, it becomes strangely home-like. The mountains, you find out they have names, there's history, and there's stories behind them. And you find out there are people like myself, like my grandmother, who inspired me to begin exploring the desert, who just love the desert and know it well. For example, when I go out into Saline Valley, out into those areas, I don't carry a map. I know it like my backyard, kind of. and so it's remarkably isolated, yet it can seem so friendly. It can seem so embracing. It can feel like nowhere you've ever been in a really good way, which is why when the Burmans disappeared, for those of us who just feel this love affair with the desert and that area in particular, it was so shocking, so appalling. The idea that somebody would come into, it's like somebody coming into your house and murdering somebody, a place that is sacred to you, and somebody murdered these people.
Who were Barry Berman and Louise Berman? Barry Berman was the heir to the Kahlua fortune. Talk about Barry and Louise Berman.
Two fascinating people, Rob. Studying about their lives, talking to their friends was an education in itself. It was some of the most fulfilling and interesting work that I've ever done. I'll tell you why. They were very different to begin with. They came from such diverse backgrounds. You mentioned about Barry. So Barry's father, Jules Berman, was this remarkable, legendary among some circles, entrepreneur. Seemed like everything he touched flourished into golden opportunities. He got into the liquor business as a young man in Beverly Hills. He opened a liquor store. Later, he said, well, he went to Beverly Hills because that's where the money is. He grew it into a chain of six liquor stores. Wow. He courted movie stars and such to build the cachet of his liquor chain called Lords with two L's. He thought that sounded classier. And then after World War II, he noticed that tastes were evolving, that as servicemen and women returned from overseas, that they had interest in foreign brands of different kinds and exotic things. And he thought that exotic liquors might play well in the American market. His first big success, he met a brewer who had a unique tasting beer called Heineken that was new to the U.S. market. And he was one of the people, Jules Berman, spearheaded bringing Heineken into the U.S. market, made a fortune off that. And then he was one of the key people behind J&B Scotch, Bass Pale Ale, Cinzano Vermouth, and other brands, which are now iconic here in the U.S. And when an opportunity came up for him to buy his own brand, an obscure Mexican liqueur called Kahlua, which was only selling fewer than 1,000 cases a year, he dove in on this and then poured money and energy into promotion and advertising. And it just took off to 1 million case a year worldwide business. He had a mansion in Beverly Hills. He had a yacht named Kahlua. He hung out with Armand Hammer and the governor of California and other bigwigs. He had a big place down in Acapulco. The one of the main people behind what later became Federal Express, him and Jules got together and had a 10,000 acre fly-in hunting reserve that they bought together. I mean, Jules was rolling big, and he got into oil and large scale real estate development. Wow. But Barry was completely different, Rob. He was from the time he was just a boy, he pushed back against his parents' ostentatious wealth. Here he is growing up in Beverly Hills in a house with servants and exotic cars in the garage. And he really wanted nothing to do with it. And Louise, so different. She grew up in working class Los Angeles. She was a survivor of sexual abuse. Her mother had multiple husbands and lovers. Louise was sexually active at an early age, was married several times. Barry was actually her fourth husband. From what we know, he may have never had a lover before Louise. So you had these two very different people come together, but they did have some things in common. Both of them had gotten into the 60s counterculture, done drugs, and discovered transcendental meditation. And they were both, at the time they met in 1980, disciples of a Punjabi guru. And so that's how they met. They had this shared faith, and something drew them together.
That's fascinating. Six liquor stores, and then everything he touched to gold. That is a tremendous story. So how did they get to where they eventually got murdered? How did they end up there and were going there for a retreat, it looks like, right? And then all of a sudden they were missing, and how did that come about?
So the way that came about was, again, they were counterculture people who consciously pushed back against wealth and materialism because they believed, sincerely believed, that the soul travels through multiple lifetimes and accumulates good and bad karma, kind of like a scorekeeping as you go. This was their faith. And so they believed that this world is just transitory. And what you really should do is focus on the eternal qualities of the soul and trying to be a better person and not get caught up in the trappings of this particular iteration of your life and materialism. Because who knows what's coming next? That was their belief. And that belief very firmly drew them together. They were peaceful people who didn't believe in the killing of animals. They wouldn't eat meat because they thought it was bad karma. They lived together in a little mountaintop place that Jules had bought them as a wedding present. It happened to be a very spectacular spot adjacent to Rancho del Cielo, which was Ronald Reagan's beloved West Coast ranch. Their property was more modest, but it had a nice home. I mean, Barry didn't completely reject everything in his father's world. He accepted some gifts from his father, but they lived modestly. They had a little ranch house on 5 acres. Barry had a workshop where he crafted iron with his hands. He very much believed in working with his hands. And they did have some difficulties, though. In 1985, they just started growing apart. I mean, these were people who didn't have some of the attributes that you might think, you know, a couple should have in common. For one thing, there was the age difference. And then they had grown up with much different experiences. Barry was by nature almost monk-like, whereas Louise was more bubbly and outgoing. For whatever reason, and we don't know these details, nobody really knew. They were very private, but they had stopped sharing a bed, and they had drifted apart. They were still living under the same roof, but something happened towards the end of 1985, and they rekindled their romance, and they decided to take a makeup trip. Well, Barry liked exploring the outdoors, and he had experience in exploring hot springs in other locations. And so one of his good friends, a guy named Arthur Korb, another disciple of Charan Singh, this Punjabi guru, suggested that they visit Saline Valley, this amazing spot. And so they decided to take a trip into the backcountry. They were well prepared. They had a little four-wheel drive Datsun pickup. They knew how to camp. They knew their way around. And even though it was an unfamiliar location for them, they skillfully navigated into Saline Valley with the idea in mind of just appreciating the natural beauty, maybe going on some walks, soaking in the hot springs, and then heading back home. Mm.
So I have Doug Carey on here with me, The Berman Murders. He's the author of Unraveling the Mojave Desert, Most Mysterious Unsolved Crime. So they end up being missing, and then three years later, you did some investigating, and you kind of took it on your own, did you not?
So yeah, here's how the timeline came down. So it took a while for folks around the hot springs to notice, wait, this truck's been sitting here for days. So the sheriff's office actually wasn't notified for a full week that the Bermans were missing. Mm. And then it took them days to get out there. So it, unfortunately, there was this lag between the time that the Bermans went missing and the search and rescue even started. But once it became clear, wait a minute, these aren't just your average campers. This guy is the son of a very powerful, wealthy, well-connected guy. The search just burgeoned. It became this huge, almost like a wartime kind of effort with helicopter assets, ground searchers, fixed-wing aircraft, massive search, and not a trace turned up. And then, almost 3 years later, a hiker stumbled across this grave. Mm. He actually spotted a skull. Presumably animals or something had partially unearthed the grave. Wow. And when investigators came and they very carefully unearthed the remains, it was clear that the Bermans, their clothing, most of their clothing had been removed. They had been stacked one atop another in this grave and very carefully concealed. Unfortunately, there was very little evidence that turned up other than something highly suggestive. And that was handcuff key. And the fact, of course, their clothing had been removed. Their shoes were gone. Clearly, they didn't just go lie down on top of each other and pull the rocks down. Somebody did this. So it was classified as a homicide, but no cause of death could be determined. And it was investigated both by the local sheriff's office, later by federal investigators, because they were found on federal land. So there was joint local and federal jurisdiction. And although they were able to identify a likely suspect, there just wasn't enough evidence to move the case forward. And it wasn't until decades later, 2014, that after years of occasionally thinking about this case, it would kind of gnaw at me. Mm-hmm. What happened to these people? That I decided, you know what? I'm going to just dive in and take a look, see what I can find. I didn't realize at the time that was going to be the start of a 9-year journey, Rob. I just wanted to dig in a little bit, see where it went. And this is where it went.
So as you were writing the book and doing the research, did it motivate you more to go find the cause of how they were murdered and possibly find a suspect? Because that seemed to have been driven you as you were going along.
Yeah, one thing led to another. I started with just interviewing some people, but then the sheriff's office turned over records, and that provided a lot more information. This deputy, Leon Boyer, he cooperated with me. People started cooperating. Ultimately, I put out a cover story, a long-form journalism story, a kind of an in-depth presentation about the case, identifying the person that they thought was a likely suspect, talking about some of the evidence. And that actually led to some new developments because the person who had been identified as a likely suspect had been convicted on other crimes and was serving time in federal prison. And his cellmate and another inmate came forward and told me that he had bragged about the murders and talked about the murders as a way of kind of elevating his status in prison, because he was in prison for sexual crimes committed against children.
Did you find out about any talking to anybody who may have been out at the desert at that time, if they saw anything that looked unusual when the Burmans were out there? Because again, this is 1986 when there were no phones, no cell phones. So you're on your own out in the middle of nowhere. Did you ever get to talk to anybody who was out there? Possibly, maybe could have lent some hints or clues.
There were very few people at the particular site at the Saline Valley Hot Springs. It's a place called Palm Spring, not Palm Springs, the city in California, but Palm Spring. It's a pair of bathing pools, soaking pools, and just some natural campsites, not even marked, maybe a few rocks in the desert that kind of indicate boundaries. And there were some people who were there at the same time as the Burmans who recalled the facts and circumstances surrounding the disappearance. There were two groups in particular. One was a trio of motorcycle riders, and I was able to locate them, interview them separately. I looked at photos that they had taken that corroborated their account of what they did when they were out there, and found out from them what they remembered. And then the hardest people to track down were a couple who saw this fellow who had been camping alone, who headed off in the same direction as the Burmans, driving a little truck up a rough Jeep trail, maybe an hour or two after the Burmans left camp. They saw him drive up that way. Burmans never came back. He came back late in the day, covered in dust and acting very nervous. And apparently he was kind of charged up because he comes into the camp of this couple, an older guy, a very accomplished mountaineer, somebody well known in the Eastern Sierra, and his younger partner, long-term partner, beautiful blonde-haired woman. And within minutes of meeting them, he starts hitting the young woman up for suggesting maybe that they should all have a threesome. I mean, can you imagine? You're out in the middle of the desert. You just meet these people at a campsite. Yeah. You're hitting them up for sex. Like, this guy was off the rails in how he was acting. And you kind of wonder, well, what drove him off the rails? What made him so charged up? What? Why would he come back to camp after all this time, covered in dirt, acting nervous, asking them, could he bum a pack of cigarettes? He'd given up smoking, but now he wanted cigarettes. And then next thing you know, he's talking about sex. So it was highly suggestive, circumstantially, that, gosh, there's nobody else around, really. There's just a limited number of people. Yeah. What's this guy's story, right? What about him?
Yeah, you know, you just mentioned it's probably a close-knit group that's out there at this area. So if somebody's acting weird, like you said, or seems out of place, somebody's going to recognize it. It's like living in a small town. Everybody knows everybody. And if they noticed that he was acting nervous, that how did you unearth that? Because I find that to be rather fascinating.
Well, the police had identified them, and so I was able to get their names. One of the names I had heard of before, because I've spent a lot of time out there. Now, finding them, identifying them and finding them were two different things. They were living off the grid and were shocked when I located them and showed up at their door. Did not want to talk initially. It took some coaxing. What I agreed to was, if you will talk on the record, I won't use your real names. I'll use pseudonyms to protect your identities, because they had some concern that by talking, they might put themselves in peril. So anyway, I was able to get the story, and it was quite a remarkable story. It fit exactly with what the police had heard decades earlier, and it very much pointed in the direction of this one fellow who happened to be there, who shared a soaking pool with the Burmans the night before they disappeared. He was a Marine Corps officer, as it turned out, traveling alone. And later, after he retires from the Marine Corps, this same guy ends up in Cambodia committing the most horrific sex crimes against children. I'm not talking that he likes to sleep with young girls. I'm talking about brutally tying up little children, raping, gagging, and beating them.
Jesus.
Now, my question to you would be, if you had to pick a guy from this limited number of people out in the middle of nowhere who might have gone off the rails in some manner and killed the Burmans, who knows, a sexual proposition gone bad? That's what the Selly said happened. Whatever the answer is, something happened, somebody did it, and everybody involved in the case thought, this guy sure seems like he's the one. Now, when I came into it, Rob, I had no preconceived notions. In fact, part of me as an investigative journalist, I wanted to see if I could find out that the authorities were wrong and they just had confirmation bias, prejudged the case and targeted one guy without looking at all the facts and circumstances. But after taking a fresh look, my conclusion was the same as Leon Boyer, as the other investigators in the Inyo County Sheriff's Office, the federal investigator, the DA. Everybody thought, this is our guy. But they just didn't have anything more than circumstantial evidence. They didn't feel they had enough. And even after I was able to get that article written and the informants came forward, the sheriff's department decided at that point to do a new report, do a homicide report. They put a veteran investigator on it. He spent 2 years on it, forwarded it up to the DA's office in hopes that charges would finally be filed. And the DA said, you know, there just isn't enough for me to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. Controversial decision, by the way. I actually, as a lawyer, I get it. I understand that how hard it could be to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Just because you can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, that doesn't mean a person's not not guilty. It's, in other words, it may not be enough for a criminal conviction, but they could still have done it. I mean, look at the OJ case, classic example, right? The jury said not guilty. Later, when the standard of proof was lower in a civil case, the jury said, he did it. And he got, So everyone, myself included, felt that this guy was the likely suspect. But Rob, there's never been an arrest, never been a conviction. In the eyes of the law, he is innocent until proven guilty. So I get that.
What a sick person that is. Sick person. So did you ever go out to like the area where the Burmans were or where the crime scene was? Because did you ever get a feeling of them being there if you were out in that area?
Well, multiple times I went out there. Again, that's an area that is very near and dear to my heart. Just to give you an idea of how near and dear to my heart it is, I mentioned that Saline Valley is ringed by these tall mountains. I've done a lot of exploration up in those mountains, perhaps as much as almost anyone, or certainly within my circle of mountaineering guys, between us, we're kind of the ones who would know that those areas the best, I think. And there's one of the mountain ranges has these steep canyons that drop into Saline Valley. And up in one of the canyons, you can drive within a mile or so of the base and then hike up to a waterfall. All three of my kids, we baptized them under that waterfall. That's how much that area means to me. And I've been involved in wilderness protection. I was one of the people involved in helping to get that area added to the boundaries of Death Valley National Park. So I know the area well. I went out there a lot. It was not easy to find the gravesite. The directions that were written in the Sheriff's Department files were based on the configuration of this very rough set of wheel tracks. Wow. And that configuration had changed because of flash flooding and the route had been reconfigured. And I had to account for that reconfiguration and then just do a lot of zigzag hiking back and forth. It took me a couple of trips actually to finally find the gravesite. But when I found it, it was exactly the way it looked in the photos. Everything, the bushes, the rock cairn that the hiker had built to show where he found the skull, all of that was still there. And I actually laid down in the grave because I wanted to get a sense for what happened there. I mean, it's a beautiful spot. So to picture that two people were murdered there isn't easy. And that's why I thought, I'm just going to lie on my back and kind of imagine these, what happened when these bodies were placed in the grave. What was there screaming? What went on in those horrific moments when these two peaceful, gentle people met their demise?
Do you get the sense maybe that they confided with this person or got maybe friendly with this person the night before they went missing? Do you get a sense maybe that they maybe found a friend and maybe that person took advantage of them?
So we know some facts about what happened in the hot tub, because when the Burmans arrived, they actually drove in after dark and they climbed into the hot tub. Two of the motorcycle riders, there were three motorcycle riders out there, dirt bike riders, young guys, rambunctious young guys who are out there playing around on dirt bikes, good guys, very honest, open. Detectives had no problem getting statements from them, getting information. They didn't try to coordinate their stories. I had the same experience with them when I met up with them. They just seemed completely credible. And besides, there was no way that Louise Berman, who had a 52-year-old woman who had a hurt ankle, was going to do anything more than a light morning walk. Mm-hmm. So if this fellow driving his little pickup truck offered them a ride, it would have been natural to say yes. And that would explain why the bodies were found so far away from camp. Whereas the motorcycle riders, they were riding dirt bikes that are made for a single person. Mm-hmm. There's no passenger foot pegs. The seat's not big enough. And I know this because I examined one of the dirt bikes. One of the riders still had it. It was out in his yard under a tarp. I pulled back the tarp and checked it out. Wow. I'd already seen the specs online, but I just wanted to see for sure. Anyway, it was hard to find the spot, but it all started to make sense and kind of tie together because they had talked to him in the tub the night before. They had talked about wanting to maybe see Indian artifacts. They had talked about maybe wanting to visit a spot called the Hogan. It looked like a Navajo Hogan, mm-hmm. although this is the territory of the Timbosha Shoshone, so it's not a Navajo location, but it was a stone structure probably built by miners in the 1930s. Anyway, it was a destination people sometimes hike to. So there were a couple of spots mm-hmm. where they might have been walking to. Now, the suspect, and by the way, I'll give him a name. His name is Michael Pepe. Pepe had been to Saline Valley a number of times. He knew about sites where you could find Indian artifacts mm-hmm. like obsidian, stone, and various kinds of things. He knew his way around. So, and he had chatted with him in a tub the night before. And by the way, he was an educated guy. He had a degree from University of New Mexico, had a very resonant voice, had a very mellow manner about him. You can easily imagine that what the inmate said later happened, actually did happen. And that is, he encounters the Burmans, invites them to get in his truck. Mm. He'll show them some spots. Louise, maybe her ankle hurts at that point, or they just think he's a nice guy. Sure, we'll go check it out. And that's how they end up with him in some remote location. Now, whether he pre-planned to kill somebody, saw an opportunity, and it aroused some sadistic urge, whether it was, as they suggested, the inmate suggested, that he hit on Louise, and that didn't go down well with Barry. Mm. And a fight ensued that escalated Jeez. Into violence. We don't know for sure, Rob.
Wow, that is unbelievable. Do you ever get the sense maybe that he may have confided to this person, maybe his father was the heir to, he was the heir to his father's fortune with the Kahlua?
Well, with Michael Pepe, now keep in mind, Michael Pepe came from a more blue-collar background. And according to his sisters, two of his sisters ended up talking with me, he's not the kind of guy who would have confessed a crime to family. However, I will say this, the idea that he might have talked about the murders as a way of elevating his jailhouse status. Now, keep in mind, if you're in middle age, maybe a little later middle age like he was, and mm-hmm. you find yourself in prison for sex crimes charges, you are not at the top of the prison pecking order. There's a culture and a social order and a status system in prison, just like there is everywhere in society, in a workplace, in a business, in society in general. There are the elites, and then there are people who are considered low on the pecking order. And when you are a child molester, or chomo, as they call them in prison, you are very low on the pecking order. You can get picked on. You can get shunned. People may be trying to force you to buy them things. You are looked down upon. Imagine facing a long time, years and years. This is your life, facing that kind of a social status. And now you have an opportunity to talk about something that makes you seem a little more badass, makes you seem a little higher on the prison status system. Hey, you got in a fight with the guy and you took him out. You had to kill the girl to get rid of the witness. That sounds more like a hardened criminal, the kind of guy that might get treated with a little more respect around prison. Being treated with respect in prison is a big thing. And it could very well be that he was trying to earn some respect. The reason I think this is plausible is not only because there are two witnesses who came forward, also because they were interviewed face to face by a veteran sheriff's investigator, and he concluded that they were serious people who had genuine reasons for coming forward. They were offended by the fact that he'd sold himself as something different than what he turned out to be, that they didn't know coming in that he was a child molester. And then also the fact that he had written a letter at one point to his family trying to justify what he did in Cambodia, trying to normalize the behavior of raping and abusing girls, like, oh, it's a different culture, that kind of thing. And I'm thinking, well, okay, so a guy who would confess a lot of stuff to try to elevate his status with his family, do you think he might confess some things in prison to try to elevate his status with people who could protect him, who could respect him, who could give him friends and a social structure? Absolutely. So the theory is very plausible, but again, it hasn't been proven. And I don't claim to have proof. What I do in the Berman Murders book is lay out the facts the way investigators found them, the way I found them, and then readers can draw their own conclusions.
I find it fascinating just in our discussion and just a couple of other things. What makes true crime so popular, like this unsolved murder, or when you have true crime, as well as finding out who the person is that committed or persons that committed? What makes it not people gravitate to watching it and listening to it?
It's a great question. It's definitely a thing now. The true crime genre has really taken off. I saw that over the course of my 9-year investigation. I don't remember at the beginning that the phrase true crime was tossed around so much, but now it's a whole subset. It's always been a thing, but now more than ever. Why do I think? Well, because there's so much that's artificial in this world, and you see it even more with AI, but all the computer-generated stuff and stories that are fables. But these are elemental dramas, and they're real, and they involve matters of life and death, and ordinary people get caught up in them. I'll give you an example of why these dramas are so gripping. I dove into a case, also in Saline Valley, by the way, about a Vietnam veteran, familiar with the area, would go and hang out there at a set of hot springs about 3/4 of a mile away from where the Burmans disappeared. That's the main hot springs. And there's kind of a whole social scene that surrounds it. This guy's name, his handle was Badwater Bob. People down at those lower springs, they call them. A lot of them have handles, and it's a whole thing. They sit around, play guitar, and people know each other. They come out weekend after weekend. Anyway, he came out and just vanished one night. Parked his truck, looked like he was probably going to use the bathroom. I concluded after investigating and after we found a key clue, I believe he got disoriented at night, fell, and then the reason they haven't found the body, I believe he crawled into one of a series of holes in a particular set of hills near where we found his broken sandal, where he could have been just swallowed up essentially because the ground is constantly shifting. And a couple of months after he vanished, there was a lot of rainfall and a lot of these caves kind of collapsed. And I'm guessing that he's entombed in one of these. Anyway, these dramas are so gripping. So I find out about this case and I want to go look into it. And I make an appointment to meet with his wife. And I show up. Her house is out in a place called Apple Valley, California. It's a bit of a drive from where I was, a couple hours. And I get there probably 5 minutes late. She opens the door and I realize she's been waiting for me. All of these photos and materials and documents about the case are spread out on the table. Mm. And suddenly I'm face to face with another human being in her home whose husband disappeared 2 years earlier, and she has no idea what happened to him. And it seems to her like nobody cares. That hits you on an emotional level. It's real. It's powerful. And that's what true crime is about. And I think that it's a combination of that elemental human drama and the fact that these are fascinating puzzles. I think those things in combination, it's kind of irresistible. I'll admit, I'm hooked on that stuff too. I listen to the podcasts, I watch the TV shows, I read the books also.
Yeah, it's amazing when you hear it, when you watch or hear. It's like, how did this happen? Why did this person just like do this crime? It boggles the mind. I mean, a certain time of your life, a small section of your life, and it changes your life forever. We have a case here in Eastern Tennessee. I'm in Memphis. There's a young girl, 6-year-old girl, that went missing in June of 2021, Summer Wells. She's still missing. It's like, how does she go missing? How do people just like go missing or crimes happen? You're right, it is. But you add the human element to it. I mean, she had the pictures out for you. I think that is tremendous. And I really think that's awesome. So I've had Doug Carey on my podcast episode. The book is The Berman Murders, Unraveling the Mojave Desert's Most Mysterious Unsolved Crime. And where can you get your book, Doug, so my listeners can get it?
Well, again, it's the Berman Murders. You can Google and see it available for purchase in a variety of places. It's on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble. You can get it directly from the publisher, Roman and Littlefield. In fact, they may even offer a discount on their website. I know they were for a while. A great publisher, by the way. I'm honored to have been selected for publication by Roman and Littlefield. So, yeah, just Google the Berman Murders or Google my name, Doug. Last name is spelled K-A-R-I. And you'll see my Facebook page. I've got a website, DougCarey.com. So a lot of places you can learn more about the cases I work on. Buy the book, give feedback, get involved. Would love to have more folks following what I do.
Well, I'm going to get the book, and I am truly honored that you came on my podcast, Doug. I really appreciate your time. Fascinating discussion, your research, writing the book. I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate you having me.